Edmund, Magnus decided, put him in mind of nothing so much as a boat, a shining, beautiful thing, buffeted by the whims of the water and winds. Only time would tell if he would find anchor and harbor, or if all that beauty and charm would be reduced to a wreck. All imaginings aside, there was no need for Magnus to play nursemaid to shadow hunters. Edmund was a man full grown and able to care for himself. It was Magnus who grew bored in the end, and coaxed Edmund out of White's for a sobering walk in the night air. They had not wandered far from St. James's Street when Magnus paused in his retelling of a certain incident in Peru, because he felt Edmund come to attention next to him. Every line of that angelic athlete's body suddenly tensed. He brought to mind forcibly a pointer dog hearing an animal in the undergrowth. Magnus followed the line of Edmund's sight until he saw what the shadow hunter was seeing. A man in a bowler hat, his hand set firmly on a carriage door, having what appeared to be an altercation with the occupants of the carriage. It was shockingly uncivil, and but a moment later it became worse. The man had hold of a woman's arm, Magnus saw. She was dressed plainly as befit an abigail or lady's maid. The man tried to wrench her from the carriage by main force. He would have succeeded but for the interference of the other occupant of the carriage, a small dark lady, this one in a gown that rustled like silk as her voice rang out like thunder.
"Anhanda, you wretch!" said the lady, and she belaboured the man about the head with her bonnet.
The man started at the unexpected onslaught and let go of the woman, but turned his attention to the lady and grasped the hand holding the bonnet instead. The woman gave a shout that seemed more outrage than terror, and struck him on the nose. The man's face turned slightly at the blow, and Magnus and Edmund were both able to see his eyes. There was no mistaking the void behind those brilliant poison-green eyes. "Demon," Magnus thought. "A demon, and a hungry one, to be trying to abduct women from carriages in a London street. A demon, and a very unlucky one to do so in front of a shadow hunter." It did occur to Magnus that shadow hunters generally hunted in groups, and that Edmund Herondale was inebriated. "Very well," Magnus said. "Let us pause for a moment and consider—" "Oh, you have already run off." "Splendid." He found himself addressing Edmund's coat, wrenched off and left in a heap upon the cobblestones, and his hat spinning gently beside it. Edmund jumped and somersaulted in mid-air, vaulting neatly onto the roof of the carriage. As he did so, he drew weapons from the concealing folds of his garments, the two whips he had spoken of before, arcs of sizzling light against the night sky. He wielded them with cutting precision, their light waking golden fire in his tousled hair, and casting a glow on his carved features. And by that light Magnus saw his face change from a laughing boy's to the stern countenance of an angel. One whip curled around the demon's waist like a gentleman's hand round a lady's waist during a waltz. The other wrapped as tight as wire about his throat. Edmund twisted one hand and the demon spun, crashing to the ground.
"You heard the lady," said Edmund.
"Unhand her." The demon, his teeth suddenly much more numerous than before, snarled and lunged for the carriage. Magnus raised his hand and made the carriage door fly shut, and the carriage jolted forward a few paces, despite the fact that the carriage driver was missing, presumed eaten, and despite the shadow hunter who was still standing atop it. Edmund did not lose his balance. As sure-footed as a cat, he simply leapt down to the ground and struck the eidolon demon a blow across his face with his whip, sending him flying backward again. Edmund landed a foot upon the demon's throat, and Magnus saw the creature begin to writhe, its outlines blurring into a changing shape. He heard the creak of a carriage door being opened and saw the lady who had punched the demon essaying to emerge from relative safety to the demon-haunted street.
"Ma'am," Magnus said, advancing, "I must counsel you not to exit the carriage while a demon slaying is in progress."
She looked him full in the face. She had large, dark blue eyes. The color of the sky immediately before night turned it black, and the hair slipping from her elaborate coiffure was black, as if night had come with no stars. Though her beautiful eyes were very wide, she did not look frightened, and the hand that had struck the demon was still clenched in a fist. Magnus made a silent vow to come to London far more often in the future. He was meeting the most delightful people.
"We must render assistance to that young man," said the lady, in a lilting, musical accent.
Magnus glanced over to Edmund, who was at present being thrown against a wall and who was bleeding rather profusely, but grinning and sliding a dagger from his boot with one hand as he choked the demon with the other. "Do not be alarmed, dear lady. He has the matter well in hand," he said as Edmund slid the dagger home. "So to speak." The demon gurgled and thrashed in its death throes. Magnus made the decision to ignore the furor behind him, and made the two women a superb bow. It did not seem to console the maidservant, who shrank into the shadowed recesses of the carriage and attempted to crawl into a pocket handkerchief, face foremost. The lady of the shining ebony hair and pansy eyes let go her hold on the carriage door and gave Magnus her hand instead. Her hand was small, soft, and warm. She was not even trembling. "I am Magnus Bane," said Magnus. "Call on me for aid at any time of mortal danger, or if in urgent need of an escort to a flower show."
"Lynette Owens," said the lady, and dimpled.
She had delicious dimples.
"I heard the capital held many dangers, but this seems excessive."
"I am aware that all this must seem very strange and frightening to you."
"Is that man an evil fairy?" Miss Owens inquired.
She met Magnus's startled look with her own steady gaze.
"I am from Wales," she said. "We still believe in the old ways and the fae folk there."
She tipped her head back to scrutinize Magnus. Her crown of midnight-colored plaits seemed like it had to be too massive for such a small head on such a slender neck.
"Your eyes," she said slowly. "I believe you must be a good fairy, sir. What your companion is, I cannot tell."
Magnus glanced over his shoulder at his companion, who he had almost forgotten was there. The demon was darkness and dust at Edmund's feet, and with his foe well and truly vanquished, Edmund had turned his attention to the carriage. Magnus observed the spark of Edmund's golden charm kindle at the sight of Lynette, blooming from candle to sun in an instant.
"What am I?" he asked. "I am Edmund Herondale, and, my lady, I am always and forever at your service, if you will have me."
He smiled, and the smile was slow and devastating. In the dark, narrow street long past midnight, his eyes were high summer.
"I do not mean to seem indelicate or ungrateful," said Lynette Owens. "But are you a dangerous lunatic?"
Edmund blinked.
"I fear I must point out that you are walking the streets armed to the teeth. Did you expect to do battle with a monstrous creature this night?"
"Not expect, exactly," said Edmund.
"Then you are an assassin?" asked Lynette. "Are you an overzealous soldier?"
"Madam," said Edmund, "I am a shadow hunter."
"I'm not familiar with the word. Can you do magic?" Lynette asked,
and placed her hand on Magnus's sleeve.
"This gentleman can do magic."
She bestowed an approving smile on Magnus. Magnus was extremely gratified.
"Honored to be of assistance, Miss Owens," he murmured.
Edmund looked as if he'd been struck about the face with a fish.
Of course I can't do magic," he managed to splutter out, sounding in true shadow hunter fashion, appalled by the very idea.
"Oh, well," said Lynette, clearly rather disappointed. "That's not your fault. We all make do with what we have. I'm indebted to you, sir, for saving me and my friend from an unspeakable fate."
Edmund preened, and in his pleasure spoke incautiously. "Think nothing of it. It would be my honour to escort you to your home, Miss Owens. The streets about Mall Pall can be very treacherous for women at night." There was a silence.
"Do you mean Pall Mall?" Lynette asked, and smiled slightly. "I am not the one overset by strong liquor. Should you like me to escort you home instead, Mr. Herondale?"
Edmund Herondale was left at a loss for words. Magnus suspected it was a novel experience, and one that would probably be good for him. Miss Owens turned slightly from Edmund back to Magnus. "My Abigail, Mangarad, and I were travelling from my estate in Wales," she explained. "We had to spend the London season with a distant relative of mine. We've had a long and tiring journey, and I wish to believe that we might reach London before nightfall. It was very stupid and reckless of me, and it has caused Angarad great distress. Your aid was invaluable."
Magnus could discern a great deal more from what Lynette Owens had told him than what the lady had actually said. She had referred not to her papa's estate, but to her own, in a casual manner, as one accustomed to ownership. That combined with the costly material of her dress, and a certain something about her bearing, confirmed it for Magnus. The lady was an heiress, and not simply the heiress of a fortune, but of an estate. The way she spoke of Wales made Magnus think the lady would not wish to have her lands cared for by some steward at a remove. Society would think it a scandal and a shame for an estate to be in the hands of a woman, especially one so young and so pretty. Society would expect her to contract a marriage so that her husband could administer the estate, take possession of both the land and the lady. She must have come to London because she'd found the suitors available in Wales not to her taste, and was on a quest to find a husband to take back to Wales with her. She had come to London in search of love. Magnus could sympathize with that. He was aware that love was not always part of the bargain in high society marriages. But Lynette Owen seemed to have a mind of her own. He thought it likely she had a purpose, the right marriage to the right man, and that she would accomplish it.
"Welcome to London," Magnus told her. Lynette dropped a small curtsy in the open carriage. Her eyes travelled over Magnus's shoulder and softened. Magnus looked around, and Edmund was standing there, one whip curled around his wrists as if he were comforting himself with it. Magnus had to admit it was a feat to look so gloriously handsome, and yet so woe-begone. Lynette visibly yielded to a charitable impulse and stepped out of the carriage. She made her way across the cobblestones and stood before the forlorn young shadow hunter.
"I am sorry if I was uncivil, or if I in any way implied that I thought you were a tipsen," said Lynette tactfully, not translating the word.
She put her hand out and Edmund offered his, palm up and whip still curled around his shirt-sleeved wrist. There was a sudden hungry openness to his face. The moment had a sudden weight. Lynette hesitated and then placed her hand in his.
"I am very much obliged to you for saving me and Angarad from a dreadful fate. Truly I am," said Lynette. "Again, I apologize if I was ungracious."
"I will give you leave to be as ungracious as you choose," Edmund said,
"if I can see you again."
He looked down at her, not making play with his eyelashes. His face was naked and open. The moment turned. Edmund's serious, humble honesty did what eyelashes and swagger had not, and made Lynette Owens hesitate.
"You can pay a call at 26 Eaton Square, at Lady Caroline Harcourt's," she said, "if you still wish to in the morning."
She drew her hand away, and after a single uncertain instant, Edmund let her. Lynette touched Magnus's arm before she ascended into the carriage. She was just as pretty and amiable as before, but something in her manner had changed.
"Please come pay a call on me as well, if you care to, Mr. Bain."
"Sounds delightful."
He took her hand and helped her into the carriage, giving her away in one light, graceful movement.
"Oh, and Mr. Herondale,"
said Miss Owens, putting her lovely, laughing head through the carriage window.
"Please leave your whips at home."
Magnus made a small shooing gesture, minuscule cerulean sparks dancing between his fingers. The carriage set off driverless in the dark, down the London streets. It was some time before Magnus attended another meeting about the proposed accords, in the main because there had been disagreements about the choice of venue. Magnus himself had voted that they meet somewhere other than the section of the Institute that had been built off sacrosanct ground. He felt that the place had the air of the servants' quarters, mainly because Amalia Morgenstern had mentioned that the area used to be the Fairchild servants' quarters. The Shadow Hunters had resisted the idea of frequenting any low den of downworlders, direct quote from Granville Fairchild, and the suggestion of staying outdoors and going to the park was vetoed because it was felt that the dignity of a conclave would be much impaired if some oblivious mundanes had a picnic in their midst. Magnus did not believe a word of it. After weeks of wrangling, their group finally capitulated and trailed dispiritedly back to the London Institute. The only bright spot was a literal bright spot. Camille was wearing an extremely fascinating red hat and dainty red lace gloves.
"You look foolish and frivolous," said De Quincey under his breath as the Shadow Hunters found their places around the table in the large dim room.
"De Quincey is quite right," said Magnus. "You look foolish, frivolous, and fabulous." Camille preened, and Magnus found it delightful and sympathetic, the way a small compliment could please a woman who had been beautiful for centuries.
"Exactly the effect I was attempting to produce," said Camille. "Shall I tell you a secret?"
"Pray do."
Magnus leaned in toward her, and she inclined toward him.
"I wore it for you,"
Camille whispered. The dim, stately room, its walls cloaked in tapestries emblazoned with swords, stars, and the runes the Nephilim wore on their own skin, brightened suddenly. All of London seemed to brighten. Magnus had been alive hundreds of years himself, and yet the simplest things could turn a day into a jewel, and a succession of days into a glittering chain that went on and on. Here was the simplest thing. A pretty girl liked him, and the day shone. Ralph Scott's thin, pale face turned paler still, and was set in lines of pain now. But Magnus did not know the boy, and was not bound to care overmuch for his broken heart. If the lady preferred Magnus, Magnus was not inclined to argue with her.
"How pleased we are to receive you all here again," said Granville Fairchild, as stern as ever.
He folded his hands before him on the table.
"At long last."
"How pleased we are that we could come to an agreement," said Magnus.
"At long last." "I believe Roderick Morgenstern has prepared a few words," said Fairchild.
His face was set, and his deep voice rang hollow. There was a slight suggestion of a kitten crying all alone in a large cave.
"I believe I have heard enough from Shadow Hunters," said Ralph Scott. "We have already heard the terms of the Nephilim for the preservation of peace between our kind and yours."
"The list of our requirements was by no means complete,"
interrupted a man called Silas Pangborn.
"Indeed it was not,"
said the woman at his side, as stern and beautiful as one of the Nephilim statues. Pangborn had introduced her as
Eloisa Ravenscar, my parabatai,
with the same proprietary air as he might have said,
my wife.
Evidently, they stood united against downworlders.
"We have terms of our own," said Ralph Scott.
There was utter silence from the Shadow Hunters. From their faces, Magnus did not think they were preparing themselves to listen attentively. Instead, they seemed stunned by downworlder impudence. Ralph persisted, despite the utter lack of encouragement for him to do so. The boy was valiant even in a lost cause, Magnus thought, and despite himself, he felt a little pang.
"We will want guarantees that no downworlder whose hands are clean of mundane blood will be slaughtered. We want a law that states that any Shadow Hunter who does strike down an innocent downworlder will be punished."
Ralph bore the outbreak of protest and shouted it down.
"You people live by laws. They are all you understand."
"Yes, our laws passed down to us by the angel," thundered Fairchild.
"Not rules that demon scum try to impose on us,"
sneered Starkweather.
"Is it too much to ask to have laws to defend us as well as laws to defend the mundanes and the Nephilim?"
Ralph demanded. My parents were slain by shadow hunters because of a terrible misunderstanding. Because my parents were in the wrong place at the wrong time and presumed guilty because they were werewolves. I'm raising my young brother alone. I want my people to be protected, to be strong, and not to be driven into corners until they either become killers or are killed.
Magnus looked over to Camille to share the spark of sympathy and indignation for Ralph Scott, so terribly young and terribly hurt and terribly in love with her. Camille's face was untouched, more like a porcelain doll's face than a person's, her skin porcelain that could not redden or pale, her eyes cold glass. He felt a qualm and dismissed it out of hand. It was a vampire's face, that was all. No reflection of how she actually felt. There were many who could not read anything but evil in Magnus's own eyes.
"What a terrible shame," said Starkweather. "I would have thought you might have more siblings to share the burden. You people generally have litters, do you not?"
Ralph Scott jumped up and hit the table with an open palm. His fingers grew claws and scored the surface of the table.
"I think we need scones," exclaimed Amalia Morgenstern.
"How dare you," bellowed Granville Fairchild. "That was mahogany," cried Roderick Morgenstern, looking appalled.
"I would very much like a scone," said Arabella the mermaid. "Also, possibly some cucumber sandwiches?"
"I like egg and cress," contributed Rachel Branwell.
"I will not stand to be so insulted,"
said a shadow hunter called Waybread or some such thing.
"You will not be insulted, and yet you will insist on murdering us,"
Camille remarked, her cool voice cutting the air. Magnus felt almost unbearably proud of her, and Ralph threw her a passionately grateful look. "It seems hardly fair." "Do you know that last time they threw away the plates that our very touch had profaned once we were gone?" Magnus asked softly.
"We can come to an agreement only if we begin at a position of some mutual respect."
Starkweather barked a laugh. Magnus actually did not hate Starkweather. At least he was no hypocrite. No matter how foul, Magnus did appreciate honesty.
"Then we won't come to an agreement."
"I fear I must agree," Magnus murmured. He pressed a hand over his heart and his new peacock blue waistcoat. "I strive to find some respect in my heart for you, but alas, it seems an impossible quest."
"Damned, insolent, magical libertine!"
Magnus inclined his head.
"Just so."
When the refreshments tray arrived, the pause in hurling insults in order to consume scones was so excruciatingly awkward that Magnus excused himself under the pretext that he had to use the conveniences. There were only a few chambers in the Institute into which downworlders were permitted to venture. Magnus had simply intended to creep off into a shadowed corner, and he was rather displeased to find that the first shadowed corner he came upon was occupied. There was an armchair and a small table. Slumped on the tabletop that depicted filigree gold angels was a seated man, cradling a small box in his hands. Magnus recognized the shining hair and broad shoulders immediately.
"Mr. Herondale?"
he inquired. Edmund started badly. For a moment Magnus thought he might fall from his chair, but Shadow Hunter Grace saved him. He stared at Magnus with blurred, wounded surprise, like a child slapped from sleep. Magnus doubted he had been doing much sleeping. His face was marked with sleepless nights.
"Had a night of it, did we?"
Magnus asked, a little more gently.
"I had a few glasses of wine with the Dachalange," Edmund said with a pallid smile that vanished as soon as it was born. "I shall never eat duck again. I can't believe I used to like duck. The duck betrayed me."
He was silent, then admitted, "Perhaps more than a few glasses.
I have not seen you in Eaton Square." Magnus wondered why on earth Edmund had thought he would, and then he recalled. It was the beautiful young Welsh girl's address.
You went to Eaton Square?
Edmund looked at him as if Magnus were dull-witted. Pardon me, said Magnus. I simply find it hard to imagine one of the mundane's glorious invisible protectors paying a social call. This time Edmund's grin was the old one, brilliant and engaging, even though it did not last. Well, they did ask me for a card, and I had not the faintest idea what they meant by that. I was turned away with vast contempt by her butler. I take it you did not give the matter up there.
No, indeed, said Edmund. I simply lay in wait, and after a mere few days, had the opportunity to follow Miss Owens, and caught up with her riding in Rotten Row. I have seen her every day since then.
Follow her? I wonder that the lady did not alert a constable. The glow returned to Edmund's face, rendering him in gold and blue and pearl again. Lynette says that I am fortunate she did not.
He added, a little shyly, we are engaged to be married.
That was news indeed. The Nephilim generally married among themselves, an aristocracy based on their belief in their own sanctity. Any prospective mundane bride or bridegroom would be expected to drink from the mortal cup, and be transformed through dangerous alchemy into one of the angel's own. It was not a transformation that all survived.
Congratulations, said Magnus,
and he kept his concerns locked in his own bosom. I presume Miss Owens will soon ascend? Edmund took a deep breath.
No, he said. She will not.
Huh? Said Magnus, understanding at last. Edmund looked down at the box he held in his hands. It was a simple wooden affair, with the symbol for infinity drawn upon the side, in what looked like burned match. This is a pyxis, he said. It holds within it the spirit of the first demon I ever slew. I was 14 years old, and it was the day when I knew what I was born to do, what I was born to be, a shadow hunter. Magnus looked at Edmund's bowed head, his scarred warrior's hands clenched on the small box, and could not help the sympathy kindling within him. Edmund spoke, in a confessional stream to his own soul and to the only person he knew who might listen and not think Edmund's love was blasphemy. Lynette thinks it's her duty and her calling to care for the people on her estate. She does not wish to be a shadow hunter, and I would not wish it or ask it of her. Men and women perish in attempts to ascend. She is brave and beautiful and unwavering, and if the law says she is not worthy exactly as she is, then the law is a lie. I cannot believe the unfairness of it, that I have found the one woman in all the world whom I could love. And what does the law say to this feeling that I know is sacred? In order to be with her, either I am meant to ask my dearest love to risk her life, a life that is worth more to me than my own, or I am meant to cut away the other part of my soul, burn away my life's purpose, and all the gifts the angel gave me. Magnus remembered how Edmund had looked in that gorgeous leap to attack the demon, how his whole body had changed from restless energy to absolute purpose when he saw a demon, when he threw himself into the fray with the simple natural joy of one who was doing what he was made for. Did you ever want to be anything else?
No,
said Edmund. He stood and put a hand against the wall and raked the other hand through his hair. An angel brought to his knees, wild and bewildered by pain.
But what of your dim view of marriage? Magnus demanded. What of having only one bonbon when you could have the box?
I was very stupid, Edmund said almost violently. I thought of love as a game. It's not a game. It's more serious than death. Without Lynette, I might as well be dead.
You speak of giving up your shadow hunter nature, said Magnus softly. One can give up many things for love, but one should not give up oneself.
Is that so, Bane?
Edmund whirled on him.
I was born to be a warrior, and I was born to be with her.
Tell me how to reconcile the two, because I cannot.
Magnus made no answer. He was looking at Edmund, and remembering when he had drunkenly thought of the Shadow Hunter as a lovely ship that might sail straight out to sea, or wreck itself upon the rocks. He could see the rocks now, dark and jagged on the horizon. He saw Edmund's future without shadow hunting. How he would yearn for the danger and the risk. How he would find it at the gaming tables. How fragile he would always be once his sense of purpose was gone. And then there was Lynette, who had fallen in love with a golden shadow hunter, an avenging angel. What would she think of him when he was just another Welsh farmer, all his glory stripped away? Yet love was not something to be thrown aside lightly. It came so rarely, only a few times in mortal life. Sometimes it came but once. Magnus could not say Edmund Herondale was wrong to seize love when he had found it. He could think Nephilim Law was wrong for making him choose. Edmund exhaled. He looked drained. "I beg your pardon, Bane," he said. "I'm simply being a child, screaming and kicking against fate, and it's time to stop being a stupid boy. Why struggle against a choice that is already made? If I were asked to choose between sacrificing my life or sacrificing Lynette's every day for the rest of eternity, I would sacrifice my own every time." Magnus looked away so as not to see the wreckage. "I wish you luck," he said. "Luck and love." Edmund made a small bow. "I bid you good day. I think we will not meet again." He walked away into the inner reaches of the Institute. A few feet away, he wavered and paused, light from one of the narrow church windows turning his hair rich gold. And Magnus thought he would turn. But Edmund Herondale never looked back. Magnus returned with a heavy heart to the room where the Shadow Hunters and Downworlders were still fighting a war of words. Neither side seemed inclined to give way. Magnus was inclined to give the matter up as hopeless. Through the stained glass windows, the curtains of night began to show the signs of drawing down to reveal the day, and the vampires had to leave. "It seems to me," said Camille, drawing on her scarlet gloves, "that another meeting will prove just as futile as these have been."
"If Downworlders continue to be insolent wretches," said Starkweather, "if Shadow Hunters continue to be sanctimonious murderers," snapped Scott.
Magnus could not quite look at his face, not after Edmund Herondale's. He did not want to watch as another boy's dreams died.
"Enough," said Granville Fairchild. "Madam, do not ask me to believe that you have never harmed a human soul. I am not a fool, and what kills Shadow Hunters have made, they have made in the cause of justice and in the defense of the helpless."
Camille smiled a slow, sweet smile. "If you believe that," she murmured, "then you are a fool." Cue another dreary, wearying burst of outrage from the assembled Shadow Hunters. It warmed Magnus to see Camille defending the boy. She was fond of Ralph Scott, he thought, perhaps more than fond. Magnus might hope that she would choose him, but he could not begrudge Scott her affection. He offered her his arm as they left the room, and she took it. They went out into the street together. And there, on the very doorstep of the Institute, the demons descended. Achiral demons, their teeth razors and their wide wings scorched black leather like the aprons of blacksmiths. They blanketed the night, blotting out the moon and wiping away the stars. And Camille shuddered at Magnus's side, her fangs out,
At the sign of Camille's fear, Ralph Scott lunged at the enemy, transforming as he went, and brought one down in a bloody tangle onto the cobbles. The shadow hunters rushed out too, weapons sliding out of sheaths and garments alike. Amalia Morganstone, it emerged, had been hiding a small tasteful axe under her hoop skirt. Roderick Morganstone ran out into the street and stabbed the demon Ralph Scott was wrestling with. From the small cart that contained her aquarium, Arabella gave a scream of real fear and ducked down to the bottom of her woefully inadequate tank.
"To me, Josiah!"
thundered Fairchild. And Josiah Waybread, no, Magnus thought it was Wayland, actually, joined him. They ranged themselves in front of Arabella's cart and stood to defend her, letting no demon pass the bright line of their blades. Silas Pangborn and Eloisa Ravenscar moved to the street, fighting back to back, their weapons bright blurs in their hands and their movements in perfect synchronization, as if the pair of them had melded into a single fierce creature. De Quincey followed and fought with them. The presence at Magnus's side was gone suddenly. Camille left him and went running to help Ralph Scott. One demon leapt onto her from behind and seized her up in its blade-like talons. Ralph howled despair and grief. Magnus blasted the demon out of the sky. Camille went tumbling onto the ground and Magnus knelt and gathered her, shaking, into his arms. He was amazed to see the gleam of tears in her green eyes, was amazed at how fragile she felt.
"I beg your pardon. I am not generally so easily overset. A mundane fortune-teller once told me that death would come to me as a surprise," Camille said, her voice trembling. "A foolish superstition, is it not? Yet I always wish to be warned. I fear nothing if only I am told that danger is coming."
"I would be entirely overset myself if my ensemble had been spoiled by demons who know nothing of fashion," said Magnus. And Camille laughed. Her eyes looked like grass under the dew, and she was brave and beautiful and would fight for their kind and yet rest against him. It was in that moment that Magnus felt as if he had stopped searching for love. Magnus looked up from Camille's enchanting face to see that the shadow hunters and downworlders were, for a wonder, not arguing. Instead, they were all observing one another, standing in the suddenly quiet street with the bodies of their foes around them, vanquished because they had stood together. There was a certain wonder in the air, as if the Nephilim could not see the downworlders as demonic when they had fought alongside them against true demons. The shadow hunters were warriors. The bonds of war meant a great deal to them. Magnus was no warrior, but he remembered how the shadow hunters had moved to protect a mermaid and a werewolf. That meant something to him, too. Perhaps there was something to be salvaged here this night. Perhaps they could make this wild idea of the Accords work after all. Then he felt Camille move in his arms and saw where she was looking. She was gazing at Ralph Scott and he was looking back at her. There was a world of hurt in his eyes. The boy climbed to his feet and vented his ire on the shadow hunters.
"You people did this,"
he raged.
"You want us all dead. You lured us here.
Are you mad?" Fairchild demanded. "We are Nephilim. If we wanted you dead, you'd be dead. We do not require demons to do our killing for us, and we certainly do not wish them to befoul our very doorstep. My daughter lives here. I would not put her in danger for anything you care to name, and certainly not for downworlders."
Magnus had to admit he had a point.
"It's you people who brought that filth to us," Starkweather bellowed.
Magnus opened his mouth to argue, and then he recalled how excessively vehement the Queen of the Fairies had been when she argued against an agreement with shadow hunters, and yet how strangely curious she had been about the details thereof, such as the time and place of their meetings. He closed his mouth. Fairchild gave Magnus a condemning glance, as if the shadow hunter could read the guilt of all downworlders on his countenance.
If what Starkweather says is true, you have lost any opportunity to forge an agreement between our people.
It was dawn then, and Magnus saw the rage pass from Ralph Scott's face as he visibly gave up his struggle. Ralph looked up at Fairchild with clear eyes and spoke in a calm, ringing voice.
You will not give us aid? Very well. We do not need it. Werewolves will take care of their own. I will see it done.
The werewolf boy evaded De Quincey's detaining hand and paid no heed to Fairchild's sharp reply. The only one he paid attention to was Camille. He looked at her for a moment. Camille lifted her hand, then dropped it, and Ralph whirled and walked away from both Shadow Hunters and his fellow downworlders. Magnus saw him square his thin shoulders as he went, a boy accepting a heavy burden and accepting that he had lost what he loved best. Magnus was reminded of Edmund Herondale. Magnus did not see Edmund Herondale again, but he heard him once more. The Shadow Hunters decided that Magnus and Camille were the most reasonable among the downworlders that they had assembled. Given that the other choices were intemperate werewolves and Alexei De Quincey, Magnus could not feel himself flattered by the preference. The Nephilim asked Magnus and Camille to come for a private meeting, to exchange information so that they could continue to correspond, independent of Ralph Scott. Implicit in their request was the promise that the Shadow Hunters might offer their protection if Magnus and Camille needed it at some future time, in exchange, of course, for magic or downworlder information. Magnus went to the meeting to see Camille, and for no other reason. He told himself that he was not thinking at all of that fight against the demons and how they had been united. When he stepped into the Institute, however, he was pulled up short by the sounds. The noises came from the depths of the building, and they were the rattling, tormented sounds of someone being flayed alive. They sounded like the screams of a soul in hell, or a soul being ripped from heaven.
"What is that?"
Magnus asked. There were only a few Shadow Hunters present at this unofficial meeting, instead of the mass of Clave representatives. Only Granville Fairchild, Silas Pangborn, and Josiah Wayland were in attendance. The three Shadow Hunters stood in the small hall, cries of agony reverberating from the tapestry-covered walls and the domed ceiling, and all three Nephilim appeared entirely indifferent.
"A young Shadow Hunter by the name of Edmund Herondale has disgraced his family name, and forsaken his calling so that he might fling himself into the arms of a mundane chit," Josiah Wayland answered with no sign of emotion. "He's being stripped of his marks."
"And being stripped of your marks," Magnus said slowly. "It is like that."
"It is being remade into a baser thing," said Granville Fairchild, his voice cold, though his face was pale. "It is against the will of the angel. Of course it hurts."
There was a shuddering scream of agony to underlie his words. He did not turn his head. Magnus felt cold with horror.
"You're barbarians."
"Do you want to rush to his aid?" inquired Wayland. "If you try, every one of us will move to strike you down. Do not dare to question our motives or our way of life. You speak of that which is higher and nobler than you can possibly understand."
Magnus heard another scream, and this one broke off into desperate sobbing. The warlock thought of the bright boy he had spent one night at a club with, his face radiant and untouched by pain. This was the price Shadow Hunters set on love. Magnus started forward, but the Shadow Hunters drew together with bared blades and stern faces. An angel with a flaming sword proclaiming that Magnus should not pass could not have expressed more conviction of his own righteousness. He heard the echoes of his stepfather's voice in his mind. "Devil's child, Satan's get, born to be damned, forsaken by God." The long, lonely cry of a suffering boy he could not help chilled Magnus through to the bone, like cold water seeping through to find a grave.
Sometimes he thought they were all forsaken, every soul on this earth, even the Nephilim. "There is nothing to be done, Magnus. Come away," said Camille's voice in his ear in an undertone. Her hand was small, but held Magnus's arm in a firm grip. She was strong, stronger than Magnus was, perhaps in all ways. Fairchild raised the boy from a child, I believe, and yet he is throwing him away like refuse into the street. The Nephilim have no pity. Magnus allowed her to draw him away into the street and away from the Institute. He was impressed that she was still so calm. Camille had fortitude, Magnus thought. He wished she could teach him the trick of being less foolish and less easily hurt.
"I hear you are leaving us, Mr. Bane," Camille said. "I shall be sorry to see you go. De Quincey hosts the most famous parties, and I hear you are quite the life and soul of any party you attend."
"I am sorry to go indeed," said Magnus.
"If I might ask why?" said Camille,
her lovely face upturned, her green eyes glittering.
"I had rather thought that London had caught your fancy and that you might stay."
Her invitation was almost irresistible. But Magnus was no shadow hunter. He could have pity on someone who was suffering and young. "That young werewolf, Ralph Scott," Magnus said, abandoning pretense. "He is in love with you. And it seemed to me that you looked at him with some interest as well."
"And if that is true?" Camille asked, laughing.
"You do not strike me as the sort of man to step aside and renounce the claim for the benefit of another." "Ah, but I am not a man, am I? I have years, and so do you," he added, and that was glorious too, the idea of loving someone and not fearing they would soon be lost. "But werewolves are not immortals. They age and die. A Scot boy has but one chance for your love. Where I might go and return and find you here again." She pouted prettily.
"I might forget you."
He bent to her ear.
"If you do, I shall have to recall myself forcibly to your attention."
His hands spanned her waist, the silk of her dress smooth under the pads of his fingertips. He could feel the swell and rise of her under his touch. His lips brushed her skin, and he felt her jump and shudder. He whispered,
"Love the boy. Give him his happiness.
And when I return, I shall devote an age to admiring you."
"An entire age?"
"Perhaps," said Magnus, teasing. "How does Marvel's poem go?" "100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze. 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart." Camille's eyebrows had lifted at the reference to her bosom, but her eyes were sparkling.
"And how do you know that I have a heart?"
Magnus raised his own eyebrows, conceding the point. "I have heard it said that love is faith."
"Whether your faith is justified," Camille said, "time will tell."
"Before time tells us anything more," Magnus said, "I humbly beg of you to accept a small token of my regard." He reached inside his coat, which was made of blue, superfine fabric, and which he hoped Camille found dashing, and produced the necklace. The ruby glinted in the light of a nearby street lamp, its heart the rich color of blood. "It is a pretty thing," said Magnus.
"Very pretty."
She sounded amused at the understatement. "Not worthy of your beauty, of course, but what could be?
There is one small thing besides prettiness to recommend it. There is a spell on the jewel to warn you when demons are near. Camille's eyes went very wide. She was an intelligent woman, and Magnus saw she knew the full value of the jewel and of the spell. Magnus had sold the house in Grosvenor Square, and what else had he to do with the proceeds? He could think of nothing more valuable than purchasing a guarantee that would keep Camille safe and cause her to remember him kindly. "I will think of you when I am far away," Magnus promised, fastening the pendant about her white throat. "I would like to think of you, fearless." Camille's hand fluttered, a white dove, to the sparkling heart of the necklace and away again. She looked up into Magnus's eyes. "In all justice, I must give you a token to remember me by," she said, smiling.
"Oh, well," said Magnus as she drew close.
His hand settled on the small silk circle of her waist. Before his lips met hers, he murmured, "If it's in the cause of justice."
Camille kissed him.
Magnus spared a thought to making the street lamp burn more brightly, and the flame within the iron and glass case filled the whole street with soft blue light. He held her and the promise of possible love, and in that warm instant all the narrow streets of London seemed to expand, and he could even think kindly of shadow hunters, and one more than the rest. He spared a moment to hope that Edmund Herondale would find comfort in the arms of his beautiful, mundane love, that he would live a life that made all he had lost and all he had suffered seem worthwhile. Magnus's ship would sail that night. He left Camille so that she might search out Ralph Scott, and he boarded his steamship, a glorious iron-hulled thing called the Persia, that had been made with the latest of mundane inventiveness. His interest in the ship and his thoughts of an adventure to come made him regret his departure less. But even so, he stood at the rail as the ship departed into night waters. He looked his last on the city he was leaving behind. Years later, Magnus would return to London and Camille Belcour's side, and find it not all that he had dreamed. Years later, another desperate Herondale boy, with blue, blue eyes, would come to his door, shaking with the cold of the rain and his own wretchedness. And this one Magnus would be able to help. Magnus knew none of that then. He only stood on the deck of the ship and watched London and all its light and shadows slide away out of sight.
The Midnight Air by Cassandra Clare and Sarah Rees-Brennan. Read by David Oyelowo.
It took Magnus nearly 20 minutes to notice the boys shooting out all the lights in the room, but to be fair, he had been distracted by the decor. It had been nearly a quarter century since Magnus had been in London. He had missed the place. Certainly New York had an energy at the turn of the century that no other city could match. Magnus loved being in a carriage rattling into the dazzling lights of Longacre Square, pulling up outside the Olympia Theatre's elaborate French Renaissance façade, or rubbing elbows with a dozen different kinds of people at the hot dog festival in Greenwich Village. He enjoyed traveling on the elevated railways, squealing brakes and all, and he was much looking forward to traveling through the vast underground systems they were building below the very heart of the city. He had seen the construction of the great station at Columbus Circle just before he had left, and hoped to return to find it finished at last. But London was London, wearing its history in layers, with every age contained in the new age. Magnus had history here too. Magnus had loved people here and hated them. There had been one woman whom he had both loved and hated, and he had fled London to escape that memory. He sometimes wondered if he had been wrong to leave, if he should have endured the bad memories for the sake of the good, and suffered and stayed. Magnus slouched down in a tufted velvet chair, shabby at the arms, worn by decades of sleeves rubbing away the fabric, and gazed around the room. There was a gentility to English places that America, in all her brash youthfulness, could not match. Glimmering chandeliers dripped from the ceiling, cut glass, of course, not crystal, but it shed a pretty light, and electric sconces lined the walls. Magnus still found electricity rather thrilling, though it was duller than witch light. Groups of gentlemen sat at tables playing rounds of faro and piquet. Ladies who were no better than they should be, whose dresses were too tight and too bright and too all the things Magnus liked most, lounged on velvet-covered benches along the walls. Gentlemen who had done well at the tables approached them, flushed with victory and pound notes. Those whom Lady Luck had not smiled on drew on their coats at the door and slunk off silently into the night, bereft of money and companionship. It was all very dramatic, which Magnus enjoyed. He had not yet grown tired of the pageantry of ordinary life and ordinary people, despite the passage of time and the fact that people were all very much the same in the end. A loud explosion caused him to look up. There was a boy standing in the middle of the room, a cocked silver pistol in his hand. He was surrounded by broken glass, having just shot off one arm of the chandelier. Magnus was overwhelmed with the feeling the French called déjà vu, the feeling that I have been here before. He had, of course, been in London before, 25 years past. This boy's face was a face to recall the past. This was a face from the past, one of the most beautiful faces Magnus could ever recall seeing. It was a face so finely cut that it cast the shabbiness of this place into stark relief, a beauty that burned so fiercely that it put the glare of the electric lights to shame. The boy's skin was so white and clear that it seemed to have a light shining behind it. The lines of his cheekbones, his jaw, and his throat, exposed by a linen shirt open at the collar, were so clean and perfect that he almost would have looked like a statue were it not for the much disheveled and slightly curling hair falling into his face as black as midnight against his lucent pallor. The years drew Magnus back again, the fog and gaslight of a London more than 20 years lost rising to claim Magnus. He found his lips shaping a name. Will. Will Herondale? Magnus stepped forward instinctively, the movement feeling as if it were not of his own volition. The boy's eyes went to him, and a shock passed through Magnus. They were not Will's eyes, the eyes Magnus remembered being as blue as a night sky in hell, eyes Magnus had seen both despairing and tender. This boy had shining golden eyes, like a crystal glass filled brimful with crisp white wine, and held up to catch the light of a blazing sun. If his skin was luminous, his eyes were radiant. Magnus could not imagine these eyes as tender. The boy was very, very lovely. But his was a beauty like that Helen of Troy might have had once, disaster written in every line. The light of his beauty made Magnus think of cities burning. Fog and gaslight receded into memory. His momentary lapse into foolish nostalgia was over. This was not Will. That broken, beautiful boy would be a man now, and this boy was a stranger. Still, Magnus did not think that such a great resemblance could be a coincidence. He made his way toward the boy with little effort, as the other denizens of the gaming hell seemed, perhaps understandably, reluctant to approach him. The boy was standing alone, as though the broken glass all around him were a shining sea and he were an island. Not precisely a Shadowhunter weapon, Magnus murmured. Is it? Those golden eyes narrowed into bright slits, and the long-fingered hand not holding the pistol went to the boy's sleeve where Magnus presumed his nearest blade was concealed. His hands were not quite steady. Peace, Magnus added. I mean you no harm. I'm a warlock the White Laws of New York will vouch for as being quite, well, mostly harmless. There was a long pause that felt somewhat dangerous. The boy's eyes were like stars shining but giving no clue of his feelings. Magnus was generally good at reading people, but he found it difficult to predict what this boy might do. Magnus was truly surprised by what the boy said next. "I know who you are."